This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two young conservative writers whose new book is getting a lot of attention. Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam are the authors of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. They say the Republican Party should be more oriented around the interests of the common man, and they sketch out what they describe as a vision of an ideologically innovative conservatism. New York Times columnist David Brooks writes, "You can discount my praise because of my friendship with the authors, but this is the best single roadmap of where the party should and is likely to head." Ross Douthat is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. Raihan Salam is an associate editor at The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation. Ross Douthat, Raihan Salam, welcome to Fresh Air. The group of voters that you're focused on in your new book is what you describe as Sam's Club voters. Who are they?
They're the working class, and there are a lot of debates about who should be described as working class in American politics. And the definition we use, which we think is the best definition, or we wouldn't use it, is voters without a college degree, and specifically without a four-year college education. We think that the lines of class in American life cut more on educational lines than they do on income lines. And so we're talking about a pool that's actually a majority of the population, voters with either no high school, a high school degree, or what an increasingly large category of voters with some college, either community college or a couple years at a four-year program.
Why are you defining them not by income but by education?
Because to a large extent, and this goes to a lot of what we're talking about in the book, which is the importance of cultural capital in American life, and the extent to which increasingly, and this is true not just in the U.S. but across the developing world, the social and cultural capital that flows from a four-year college education is probably the most important determinant of success across your career path. And what this means is that, you know, someone who's technically only making $35,000, $25,000 a year a couple years out of college, but who went to, I mean, to be extreme about it, an Ivy League school, is in an enormously different position socially and economically than somebody who's making $45,000 a year but doesn't have a college degree. So it's to avoid that kind of – it's basically to avoid counting someone who's, you know, doing Teach for America after going to Harvard as being working class, that you shift to education from income.
Let me quote something that you write in your book, Grand New Party. You say, having turned class politics to its advantage on cultural matters by highlighting the gulf between middle American values and the mores of the liberal overclass, the conservative movement has missed opportunity after opportunity to do the same on the economic front. By confusing being pro-market with being pro-business, by failing to distinguish between spending that fosters dependency and spending that fosters independence and upward mobility. So you're saying that conservatives haven't really represented the working class in a good way. You're saying that the economic policies have been better for business than working class people.
Well, one big thing that we talk about in the book is the idea of family-friendly tax reform, and really a broader constellation of pro-family policies, of which tax reform is the biggest. I think for a long time, Republicans have viewed cutting taxes on investment as a central conservative plank, and we think that they're right. It should be central to conservatism, the idea that you want taxes lowest on entrepreneurial Americans making investments in the future, the kind of investments that expand the economy and make it grow and so forth. But we also think that a pro-family party should recognize that raising children is one of the biggest investments that Americans make. And for a lot of working-class Americans especially, it's one of the most costly investments that people make. And the tax code should be more weighted than it already is, we think, towards families with children, especially in the years when the children are young. And that ties into a broader array of policies that we sort of sketch out without going into too much detail, which would make it easier for either mothers or fathers, frankly, to take a little more time off and have more flexible work schedules when their children are young.
I'd like you to give a very short overview, if you wouldn't mind, about what shape you think your party is in right now.
I think the Republican Party is in pretty grim shape in some broad, long-term sense. I think that it's entirely possible that John McCain will win in 2008, but I think that doesn't change the fact that when you look at the demographic basis of this coalition, it's shrinking. You're talking about a party that's pretty male. You're talking about a party that, you know, rests on the voters of a lot of married white women, a party that draws very heavily on supermajorities of the white working class. The white working class is shrinking as a slice of the population. The party has lost ground with Latinos and with Black Americans. And the party just seems to always be changing the subject from what Americans really want to talk about. They want to talk about healthcare, education, and jobs. And the Republican Party insists on talking about national security and terrorism, which increasingly look like their two last strengths with the public. And that's it's very worrying to people who care about the future of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest challenge, and it's one we try and tackle in our book, is that the Republican Party has become a working class party, but it's become, as Raihan says, largely a white working class party. And the challenge for Republican politicians demographically over the next 20 to 30 years is to persuade Hispanic and also Black American working class voters to vote the way white working class voters do right now. And that's a challenge I'm not sure the Republican Party is prepared to meet.
I'm wondering, you are both in your 20s and are considered kind of like rising stars of the young intellectual part of the Republican Party.
I might not go that far.
Andrew Sullivan, who is a friend and colleague of yours, has described you both as part of the first generation of American intellectuals to have emerged from the blogosphere. So I wonder how you react when you hear John McCain, the presumptive Republican nominee, say, "I am learning to get online by myself."
I think that John McCain is an incredibly charming person. I also think that he absolutely doesn't represent the future of the Republican Party. I think that this is a highly unusual election in a lot of ways. But when you look at that demographic composition of the Republican Party and where the party needs to go in order to build a majority, I think it really needs to look to figures like Sarah Palin, who is a mother of five, yet someone who is also the mayor of a fast-growing suburban town, someone who really
connects. She's now the governor of Alaska.
Now the governor of Alaska. I think that, you know, it's figures like that who don't come from that tight, narrow demographic box of aging, cranky white man that has been a rich source of Republican politicians for, you know, a really long time now. So I think that, you know, that is not entirely encouraging. But at the same time, the mere fact that he's not, you know, as web savvy as, say, you know, Ross or I, you know, doesn't mean that he doesn't have the right skills to lead the country.
Maybe. I mean, let's be fair here. It's not a good sign either for the Republicans or for John McCain's candidacy that he doesn't know how to use the internet and uses terms like the Google and so on. There's no question about that. I mean, I think the danger for the Republicans with McCain is that he ends up being if he wins the election, he ends up being a figure a little bit like John Major was in Britain coming after the Thatcher years and winning an election maybe he shouldn't have, that ended up setting the conservatives in Britain back more than it helped them. I think something similar happened with Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, where he was effectively just became the last Democratic president of a long Democratic era instead of building bridges to the future of the party. And I think, you know, the challenge for McCain is that the Republicans need a new direction, and he's sort of running as the last of the Reagan conservatives, which isn't what the party needs right now.
So who do you think is going to win, and how do you think that's going to affect the future of the Republican Party?
I think Obama's going to win. I think he's probably going to win by a narrow margin, probably the margin that he has in the polls right now, 3 or 4 percentage points. I think that Obama's, you know, has so many things going for him, and there are so many things going for the Democratic Party right now with the economy and so forth, that it's hard to see how he doesn't win. But I think he's also a weak enough figure in certain ways that he's not going to achieve a total landslide victory. And I think then the Republican Party, you know, then the fights can really begin. I think, you know, I think it'll be good for the GOP. I think the GOP is in the same position in a way that the Democrats were in the early 1970s, sort of facing the end of a long era of dominance and trying to adjust to new realities. And one problem for the Democrats was they never got completely beaten. You know, Reagan won in a landslide in 1980, but the Democrats still held the House and so on. And like they kept being able to tell themselves that they were still America's natural majority party, even when they weren't. And you know, I'm rooting for John McCain to win in November, but I can also see a way in which, you know, having Republicans wake up and realize that, you know, they're in real trouble wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
You know, I'm wondering, I've never been to one of Grover Norquist's famous Wednesday meetings, but my understanding of those meetings is that the people participating included people who represented very kind of diverse diverse agendas within the Republican Party, from the religious right to the anti-tax groups, the gun rights groups, the anti-abortion groups, the business groups, the anti-regulation groups. And so they'd all come together once a week and figure out how to get on the same page. Is that still being effective? Do you think that kind of alliance is still holding as strongly as it was a few years ago?
I don't think so, because I think that when you're looking at a lot of, for example, very big corporations, they have this sense, you know, ay, 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 what are we going to do with these healthcare costs? If you look at Detroit and their anxieties, if you look at Walmart and its concerns about how they're going to provide benefits for their employees and yet still remain a viable business, I think that there's increasingly, business leaders who believe that a more heavily regulated economy is going to work to their advantage. And of course, there have always been business leaders who believe that, and that's the problem with having a pro-business as opposed to a pro-market, pro-competition party. It's that you're always going to have people who are going to try to give themselves advantages through the political process. But I also think that there are, you know, real, genuine problems that the idea of a leave-us-alone coalition doesn't really speak to. And I think that that's one reason why Norquist is, frankly, a fading figure on the political right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Norquist, you know, what his breakfasts represent are the model that brought the current Republican majority to party, which is essentially assemble a coalition of interest groups who are united because they have some grievance with the existing liberal establishment. The problem is, you know, what happens when you become the establishment and then you're united only by your grievances? How do you go about governing? And I think that that's been a big problem for the Republicans over the last 4 to 8 years. I think part of what we're talking about in our book, frankly, is trying to move conservatism beyond this kind of interest group approach to politics, which, you know, you saw it from the Democrats with Bill Clinton, where you're sort of, you know, narrowly targeting different constituencies. And you saw it in the Bush administration where, you know, you'd say, OK, we're going to win, you know, blue collar workers in Ohio and Pennsylvania with steel tariffs. And then we're going to win values voters with a gay marriage appeal and so on. And that's a good way to get to 51% in a hotly contested election. It's not a good way to build an enduring majority party, I think.
Now, in your book, Grand New Party, you write that you both grew up in the heart of blue America, even though you're conservative. What was blue about it? Where did you grow up?
Rahan.
I grew up in a couple of neighborhoods in Brooklyn. I grew up in Borough Park until I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And then I grew up in a neighborhood in Greater Flatbush that's on the fringe of Kensington and Ditmas Park, a very diverse neighborhood. It was the best place to grow up, in my view. I have incredibly romantic memories of, riding my little tricycle around on concrete and eating lead paint and asbestos chips and just having a generally grand old time around lots of non-traditional families. I had friends of different backgrounds. It was a wonderful place, and that's part of why I have no hostility towards blue America. It was a great place to grow up, but I was also always a natural contrarian. So I think that, you know, partly contributed to my – I didn't even meet a Republican until I was, I think, 16 years old. So, but yeah, that's the world I'm from.
And Ross?
Yeah, I'm from – and I grew up in suburban New Haven, and my parents were both, sort of 70s liberals, I guess, in a fairly conventional way when I was growing up. My earliest political memory is my mother dragging us out to a polling station and saying, I need to grab every woman by the lapels and tell them to vote for Geraldine Ferraro. This was the 1984 election. And then I remember, you know, putting together the pieces of the map. We had a puzzle map of the states and we put them together as Clinton won in 1992. So I think, and I had a similar experience to Raihan. It was sort of a, you know, I was a contrarian growing up in, you know, suburban Connecticut, which is a fairly liberal environment, not probably as liberal as Brooklyn, but still fairly liberal. But in our case, we also became religious and eventually converted to Catholicism. And more so than Raihan, I think a lot of my conservatism does grow out of sort of socially conservative convictions that are rooted in religious belief.
You're saying your family became religious or you personally converted?
My family. I mean, we were, you know, I was raised initially Episcopalian, but we had sort of, I guess you could say, deeper religious experiences when I was a kid and temporarily became actually Pentecostals and moved sort of in the evangelical world. And then my mother converted to Catholicism when I was 16, and I converted to Catholicism when I was 17. So it took me another year to sort that out. But
I'd like you to each mention a cultural or political turning point in your life that helps explain how you became a conservative growing up in a more liberal environment.
Well, this is a minor thing, but I do think it's illustrative. I think that the world that I grew up in, the sort of liberal suburbia and going to a fairly liberal private school in the 1990s, was a little bit frozen in time. It sort of, you know, it had been deeply hostile to Ronald Reagan and had sort of been hostile to conservative ideas. And so I think I was sort of like the neoconservatives of the 1970s, who were liberals who sort of became conservatives. I just had their experience by reading books about that era and sort of coming to it late. But I remember one moment when I was assigned to do a project about global population, and I was, you know, a big, you know, at that point I was sort of a conventional liberal 14-year-old, and, you know, we'd been taught that overpopulation was the dominant problem in human societies worldwide. And I went and read, you know, Paul Ehrlich's famous book, The Population Bomb, about how population was going to destroy the world, overpopulation was going to destroy the world. And then it's like, well, you know, that book was written in 1972, I think, or the late 60s, and none of that has panned out. And then I started reading more, and it became clear that, well, actually, you know, overpopulation is a problem in some places, but actually sort of the birth dearth is an underpopulation potentially is a bigger problem in Western society. And, you know, it was a small moment of questioning the orthodoxy of my liberal upbringing, but I think it was it was repeated on a lot of different issues.
And Rehan?
I think for me, I just very late, I just looked back, reflected on my childhood, and just found that I had very unconventional ideas about inequality. A lot of my dear friends were just very panicked about economic inequality per se, and I just felt like my family had been downwardly mobile after they came to this country. They were very, very poor for a long period of time. Then they were
They came here from Bangladesh?
They came here from Bangladesh, exactly. And they had a lot of struggles, and they later encountered a Bengali-speaking community. But just being steeped in that world and being in a world where I know that my parents made me feel very comfortable, made me feel very confident, like I could talk to anyone. And I have two older sisters who had a big effect on me as well. But I just felt like money didn't seem to be the essential thing that really drove me forward. It was really just having two parents and seeing other folks, other friends of mine who didn't, and seeing incredibly miserable rich people later in my life when I got to be a part of the wider world, just really made me think that the kind of materialistic, economistic, narrow view of inequality and how it affects people's lives was wrong. Not that inequality doesn't matter, because I emphatically believe that it does, but just that an inequality of relationships and care is something that really matters. And again, my parents are, you know, left of center, and God bless them. I hope they always will be, charmingly so. But I just think that sense that, you know, even though we didn't have a lot of money, we just had this very full, rich life, I just think has made me a little skeptical about what I see as the dominant strain in contemporary liberalism.
You both have blogs. Okay. Compare for me the left and the right's presence in the blogosphere. Who do you think does a better job? And do you think that the left and the right use the blogosphere any differently?
I think if you look back to 2003 and 2004, the dominant voices in the blogosphere were right wing. And I think that, you know, the right seemed to have sort of stolen a march on the left in that respect. But I think the mistake that the right made is, you know, the conservatives had always dominated sort of alternative media, right? They dominated in talk radio. They dominated in direct mail advertising. And, you know, and so they tried to use the internet sort of in the same way they'd use talk radio, basically just as a way to critique the mainstream media and basically to say, oh, you know, look what the New York Times said today. Like, you know, here's the truth. Or to critique, to sort of try and win specific political victories, like when the Powerline bloggers figured out that the memos that Dan Rather had that supposedly related to Bush's National Guard service were fake. That was a big coup for the right-wing blogosphere. What the left figured out is that the way to use the blogosphere is as a social networking device and as a way, you know, a sort of quasi-Facebook sort of organizational tool that lets you, you know, build infrastructure and raise enormous amounts of money. And that's – and having figured that out, they've basically just raced way ahead of the right.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks very much, Terry.
Russ Douthat and Raihan Salam are the authors of the new book, Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Douthat is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. Salam is an associate editor at The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.